My first year as executive director of Save One Life was an exciting one. I was full of energy and desire to learn and find ways to help. I wanted to get out into the field and meet as many partners as I could. And I also wanted to learn what we could do better. What are we missing? Throughout that year, a common story kept presenting itself. Women with bleeding disorders are wildly underrepresented, underdiagnosed, and experiencing unneeded trauma. And that was in the U.S. What was it like in countries where diagnosis was also very limited in general? I was able to connect with a few of our partners throughout the year, and they kept highlighting that this was a significant issue. I wanted to do something, but how could we start? The first opportunity came on my first official visit as Save One Life's executive director to Kenya. I was traveling with a team of climbers that would be traveling to Kilimanjaro. Memories of my mountaineering days kept coming back, and the joy I felt at hearing the Jambo Bwana on the top of the mountain. But this time, I wasn't there just to climb. The schedule included visiting the homes of many beneficiaries, but also a group meeting at a local hospital. Before I visited, the president of the Jose Memorial Hemophilia Society, Maureen Maruka, and I chatted about providing an opportunity for women and girls impacted by bleeding disorders to speak. That demographic has never had that opportunity, and it seemed like a great place to start. My name is Chris Bombardier, and I'm a mountaineer with hemophilia. From 2011 to 2018, I successfully climbed the seven summits, the tallest mountain on each of the seven continents. But when that journey was over, I realized my next adventure was just beginning. I soon began my advocacy work with Save One Life to bring help, compassion, and resources to the bleeding disorder community around the world. And most importantly, learn from them about the challenges they face and what we can do to educate and help. Global healthcare is full of its own peaks and valleys. And if there's anything I learned climbing the seven summits, it's that there's always another mountain to climb. This is the final summit, season two, The World After the Mountains.
This next segment is brought to you by Genentech. Genentech makes sure that people with hemophilia always have someone in their corner. That's why they've made it possible for you to connect with an account and community manager, or ACM. ACMs offer one-on-one support and can help navigate the insurance process. ACMs are Genentech employees and do not provide medical advice. Always talk to your doctor about treatment options. Sign up for one-on-one support from your local account and community manager at www.talktoanacm.com.
This is Maureen Maruka.
My name is Maureen Maruka. I am based in Nairobi, Kenya. I'm a mother to Ethan, who's a 14-year-old with hemophilia. And what I do day to day is to work for Care USA, Food and Water Systems, a team. I'm a gender specialist, but my title is Hub for Strategic Partnerships and Research.
I met you in 2011, which is hard to believe. It's been over a decade. But in 2019, we got to do something very special, which was a program where women and girls in the community were able to gather and meet for the first time. Can you talk a little bit about that event and what inspired you to hold that conversation?
When Ethan was born, and then I had this extensive bleeding, actually back to the pregnancy, maybe about 5 months of his pregnancy, I experienced a bleeding episode. And it was so severe. Thankfully, I didn't lose him. I lived near the Aga Khan Hospital at that time, and I was able to rush to the hospital, and I had this doctor. The pregnancy had already begun with complications at 6 weeks. I was told it was not viable. We cannot find the fetal pole. And it meant that at that time, we began to be very careful about this pregnancy. Got one of the best doctors, Dr. Rukaria, to manage the pregnancy. And so once I had any complication, I would rush to her. Let's meet at the hospital right away. Otherwise, I wouldn't have Ethan now. And that was the first one. And then I had a second one again. And to think that I had traveled just at around 5 months of pregnancy, all the way to South Africa and all the way to Grahamstown and 5 hours on the road, and then came back. And then a month after I had all these conversations, I just really believed that this child was meant to be. And so I had again a second bleeding episode. Like I'm just laying in bed and I turn around and wow, there's blood over there. And I called the doctor and said, come into the hospital again. So after that, we began to monitor the pregnancy very closely. We had to do the Doppler scan every 2 or 3 days. And one time the doctor said, you know what, Maureen? The baby has its cord round the neck like twice. You need to come in like right away. So I went in and we had delivered the baby the following morning. And when I woke up, of course, Dr. Deve had come in and done the test and everyone was there. When I woke up at 4 p.m. of the following day and the surgery was in the morning, and the doctor said, you know what, Maureen? The baby had the cord around its neck like 3 times. I have ever seen that oh so rarely in my medical practice. And remember, she's one of the top gynecologists in Kenya. And then, okay, I'm just trying to say how much drama there was. Then the bleeding would not stop. I would not stop bleeding. I had such a bleeding after the birth, and I was like, am I going to die and leave this baby? The bleeding was heavy, and I had to get the small diapers and then cut the sides that are elastic and use them as pads because then they would go all around. That is what would work. And 4 months into it, I told the doctor, you know what, I'm done here. Yeah, I'd like to see this and have a hysterectomy because, first of all, with all the experiences I've had, I'm done bathing. I'm done having this. You say, no, you're not 34.
Yes.
And you cannot have, we allow women to have hysterectomies at 35 and above. And I said, I want this now. If you won't do it, someone else will do it. So I went ahead and had a hysterectomy. So fast forward to when we have this meeting in 2019, and we stand in the room and you're like, I had a hysterectomy. When I talk to other people, even the networks that we've worked with you together, the people that have come here visiting, and they're like, I had a hysterectomy because of this and this. So we began to find some common threads, which then women bleeders had. But back in the day, at that time, there was no focus on women bleeders as such. I actually remember during Ethan's pregnancy, I nearly had a fall in the bathtub. I'm telling you, that pregnancy. And I prevented myself from getting it, hurt my thigh. And then I had a hematoma like that large on my thigh
for a long time.
Even when I had the surgery and the hysterectomy, I had a huge hematoma on my abdomen. So fast forward, when we come to put these links together and saying, let us get together and get the women bleeders here to talk about our stories, you saw how taken in I was, how surprised, how messed up I was to say, this is a common story amongst so many women, same experiences. Of course, we want to focus on our children first because that is the focus. But then we realize there is a need here. Women who are carriers and who bleed and have those symptoms. So that is how that conversation began. But before then, of course, I had already been reading and there had been forums, the conference, the annual conference by the World Federation of Hemophilia also had sessions and things like that about bleeding. And I had read a bit about more of that. So it was nice to get, let's come all the women together and let's talk about our bleeding issues.
Your story just speaks volumes too of all of those instances. You had the hematoma on your leg from the fall, the large one from obviously the heavy bleeding after delivering Ethan. Was there ever any moment where one of the doctors brought up the fact that you could have hemophilia yourself or a bleeding disorder yourself? Was that ever part of the conversation?
No, actually, but I remember when I had what procedure did I have? Because before my hysterectomy, of course, I needed to have a pap smear and I bled more than usual. And the doctor said, you, this hemophilia of yours. And that was it. But that actually triggered me to go and read because my pap smear was normal.
Yeah.
So that triggered me to go and read about why did the doctor say you and that hemophilia of yours, and I bled more, a lot more from just a small procedure because then they had to pack and make sure that I wasn't bleeding anymore just from doing a pap smear. So that was the closest I came to a doctor saying, you know what, you're a hemophilia carrier and therefore that hemophilia of yours. I'm sure he said it as a gyna, maybe a hematologist. I don't know if they would have taken it further. Yeah. But I think in our context, what would they have done anyway?
I'm sure you hear stories too of so many of the women that I talk to actually ultimately diagnosed themselves. They did their own research and then brought the idea to a doctor who maybe officially diagnosed them, but it was only because they had the educational skills, the time, the money to put in a lot of effort to kind of be their own sort of health detective, and that obviously shouldn't have to happen.
Author and journalist Maya Dusenberry.
My name is Maya Dusenberry. I'm a journalist and author of the book Doing Harm, the truth about how bad medicine and lazy science leave women dismissed, misdiagnosed, and sick. In the book, I lay out the two big problems when it comes to women's health as the knowledge gap and the trust gap. So the knowledge gap just refers to the fact that for decades, if not centuries, things were focused on male concerns, studied male bodies. It really wasn't until the early 90s that there was a recognition that women needed to be enrolled in clinical studies and we needed to be at least looking to see if there were any differences by gender. And also the knowledge gap is about the fact that a lot of conditions that disproportionately impact women have been neglected entirely and received very little research funding and sort of attention in medical schools. And then the trust gap refers to the kind of tendency that so many women come up against where healthcare providers really dismiss or normalize and especially psychologize their complaints. So in the absence of a ready explanation for what's going on, there's a tendency to say, well, you're just being this hysterical woman. In the book, I really trace this history, which I also found really fascinating, of this concept of hysteria that has been this sort of catch-all diagnostic category that women's mysterious symptoms have been blamed on for decades, and how that sort of concept of psychosomatic illness is really still alive and well, and I think is a big reason why women so often do find their symptoms dismissed in that kind of particular way.
When I was a kid, I thought hemophilia was a male disease. It's what we were told, and I had no reason to disbelieve it. I was told as much by the doctors in my life, and they were told by their medical genetic textbooks. Females can carry it, but what's important is that they pass it on to the man. I remember seeing one book that even said, "This is how males get hemophilia." I never questioned it, because I was dealing with my own trials. Growing up with hemophilia was hard. It hurt. There wasn't as much education around it, and it made me feel like an outcast. It also just seemed unfair. All the other kids don't have to deal with this, so why should I? But at least I knew what I had. And others knew too. And when I went to the emergency room, I knew that the doctor would believe me. I don't know what I would have done if every time I saw a doctor, I had to convince them I was telling the truth before we could even treat my pain. For women across the world, not just in developing countries, but here in the US too, there's an added barrier to entry, which not only makes finding the right care harder, but it makes it feel hopeless even looking for help.
You were mentioning in the book just how long it takes sometimes women to get diagnosed with a particular medical condition compared to men. Could you kind of elaborate on that? And I think that would probably blow most listeners' minds.
That is one of the biggest ways to see this bias in the data, because it is an issue that I think is understudied. There's been some sort of experimental studies to show that doctors make different diagnoses based on gender, but I think we also see it in the real world in the fact that for so many conditions, women tend to have these longer diagnostic delays. And often those delays are coming not just because maybe the patient themselves is waiting before seeking treatment, but after they've entered the medical system, looking at autoimmune diseases. There are studies showing that for RA or other autoimmune diseases, women have to go to more doctor's appointments before they get a referral to a specialist and see longer delays for that reason. One particular study that was, I think, interesting was a survey of rare disease patients, so a really wide range of rare diseases. And for some of them, the diagnostic delay between men and women was years. So, you know, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a genetic condition, I think women were diagnosed in 16 years, and for men it was like 4. And then we also see more acutely when it comes to things that bring people into the emergency room. We see a delay when it comes to getting pain medication. Women tend to wait, I think it was 16 minutes longer than men when they're complaining of abdominal pain in the ER. So that kind of, even a smaller delay on that scale when it comes to something like a heart attack where time is really critical, that can be the matter of life and death.
Wow. Yeah, that's those numbers and those examples are just shocking. I feel like we always think we live in this like very advanced, equitable health system. I would say equitable. I'm doing like air quotes. There's many things that make our health system not equitable. But yeah, getting paid meds in the hospital, it's fascinating. Yeah, one of the statistics in your book that blew my mind, because in our bleeding disorder community, we're very familiar with like clinical trials and things like that. But the fact that women that could become pregnant weren't even allowed in clinical trials until I think it was the 90s, I was just shocked. So it obviously biases all studies towards men, which was incredibly fascinating to hear.
Yeah, that was surprising to me too. I think there are various reasons for that exclusion. Partly it was just a lack of knowledge that it really might matter. The researchers argued, well, women and men are basically comparable except for their reproductive system, so we can just study men and extrapolate results to women. But then simultaneously, they made the argument that the reason we can't include women in our studies is that these varying hormonal cycles will really complicate the results, which is, these are just two totally at odds excuses, where it's like either women matter because they're different enough that they might affect the results, in which case we should certainly be including them and studying them, or it doesn't matter, but you can't really have it both ways. And then the third reason, as you point out, is that this fear of sort of potential harm to these potential fetuses in case women became pregnant during the trial, even if they weren't at risk for that at all. It's just, yeah, really shows how women's health was put secondary to the health of a hypothetical fetus.
Once again, Maureen Maruka.
But back in the day, at that time, there was no focus on women bleeders as such. I actually remember during Ethan's pregnancy, I nearly had a fall in the bathtub. I'm telling you, that pregnancy. And I prevented myself from getting it, hurt my thigh. And then I had a hematoma like that large on my thigh for a long time.
Oh my gosh.
Even when I had the surgery and the hysterectomy, I had a huge hematoma on my abdomen. So fast forward, then we come to put these links together and saying, let us get together and get the women bleeders here to talk about our stories. You saw how taken in I was, how surprised, how messed up I was to say, this is a common story amongst so many women, the same experiences. Of course, we want to focus on our children first because that is the focus, but then we realize there is a need here.
I think it's just a really interesting global kind of phenomenon where women aren't getting triaged the same way for their symptoms as men. And it sounds like similar in Kenya as well.
Yes.
So go ahead.
I'm saying, and that's still the same. Like after we had that meeting and that program and that recognition, and we do now have a WhatsApp group on women bleeders, and we have conversation and then change and share stories and then support one another. We are still at that point as where people cannot actually get diagnosed. We don't have the testing facilities to test women bleeders and carriers and just take any other work going forward. Take it aside of the social support and the recognition that women bleed, and therefore this is what you can do in the meantime to help. We don't have any advanced programs going on as we have like for direct hemophilia.
Do you think that's like a pushback on the fact that a lot of healthcare providers still see hemophilia as a male disease or a male disorder, and like women can't be impacted, or is it more just a limitation of the capacity for testing in Kenya?
I think it's more of a limitation because they already have not even figured out how to get all the people with hemophilia, and we have not figured out how to get them all together before we can begin to address the women's issues. We've made great strides with regards to hemophilia care, both at the society and at Kenyatta and other branches around the country. But I think the next conversation now is about how to work with women bleeders, because that also helps with diagnosis, of hemophilic. So I just really think I know for sure it's the capacity.
Once again, Maya Dusenberry.
There are studies showing when it comes to children, when girls complain of pain, they're more likely to be dismissed, and boys' pain is taken more seriously, which surely has to do in part with these stereotypes that really we start believing in at a young age, that men are supposed to be more stoic and women are permitted the ability to be more emotional when it comes to pain. And so that leads to this kind of tendency to, when boys or men report pain, there's sort of an assumption that they must really mean it because they're reluctant to do that to begin with.
Each experience is individual. One of the things that made me feel very sad, and I've never forgotten that, is this lady who stood up and said, I faced castigation from my own family for having all of that bleeding, both from my in-laws and from my family. Even my own sisters would not support me in this condition. So I had to move away from home, go into this other place and try and sell cereals just to make do with my son. That demonstrated a lot of what goes on. So first of all, with stigma, and because it runs in families, you'll find people saying, do not marry from that family because their children get sick. Do not marry from that family because the women tend to bleed like too much, isn't it? And then you don't have the facilities that you need to be able to stem the bleeding. What that also led to is that this lady who came in and gave this story about her being castigated both by her own family and her in-laws, and her son had done high school and she was not able to take him to college, of course, I had to say, can I meet your son? And they came to my house. And that boy, when you see him on Facebook, he calls me mom. And then we are friends to say, how can we turn this situation around from the mother's situation and to the son's situation? And that story has replicated itself a few times in the families that we have dealt with, in saying that the women are the main, they are the carriers, you know, of this gene with hemophilia. They are the ones that bear the boys with hemophilia, and how this is how the condition is impacting them. And so it is a whole package. We need to be dealing with the mothers and we need to be dealing with the boys. And that is how come now we have begun programs that are specific to even the mothers, looking at women getting grants because they bear the inordinate, the heavier burden of taking care of the boys with hemophilia.
It's a common misconception that hemophilia is only a male disease, or that bleeding disorders in general only affect men. And while it's more commonly found in men, it's hard to figure out if that's because it's actually more common, or if it's because that's the only place we've traditionally looked. For most women around the world, healthcare has never been equal. We need to reframe the conversation and begin questioning what we've always known in a traditionally male world. It's time to shine a spotlight on the inequality gender plays in treatment and diagnosis around the world. Thankfully, a seismic shift has begun in our understanding of healthcare and gender. But the conversation is only beginning. It requires us to throw away years of tradition in favor of a more just and equitable world. Not just in nations who lack access to resources, but in wealthy nations like mine. In the US, the more we understand where traditional medicine has failed, the more we can undo generations of injustice and finally make a more equitable world. It's on us, all of us, to find our blind spots and change. Next week, we'll head to India to discuss the importance of advocacy and the importance of factor.
It's not a time that we're gonna back out, that we're gonna desist. We're not gonna wait until a new person comes into office, but we're going to keep pushing on this person. And for us, it's important that they see the result.
I'm Chris Bombardier. Until next time, keep climbing your own mountain.
The Final Summit is produced by Bloodstream Media. Learn more at bloodstreammedia.com. This episode is hosted by Chris Bombardier, written by Drew Johnson, edited by Greg Bernard, produced by Keith Corneluk. Executive produced by Patrick James Lynch. The Final Summit was also made possible by support from Genentech. Visit genentechhemophilia.com to take a look at how they are supporting the hemophilia community.